You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thoreau famously said, "Our life is frittered away by detail. Simplify, simplify, simplify." After a couple of decades in academia as a law professor, Cass Sunstein spent 3 years heading OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Obama administration, and Simpler, the Future of Government is his latest book. He has written or edited over 30 of them, and in this book he describes his experiences trying to implement the ideas that he had in an earlier book called Nudge, which he co-authored with Richard Thaler. Professor Sunstein's new book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hello. I hope that wasn't too complicated.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Does Simpler pick up where Nudge left off?
In many ways, it does. I mean, it's more broadly focused on government and the environment and healthcare and a lot of things that happened over the last few years, but it has an obvious relationship to the idea of nudging.
Well, you were here 5 years ago to discuss Nudge. I'm sure some of our listeners remember it in great detail, but can you refresh our memories of the basic ideas you and Richard Thaler set out in that book?
Yeah, the basic idea in that book is that government can often help people live more prosperous lives and be healthier without any coercion. So sometimes you can have a disclosure of information, which will get people to stay away from risks, or you can automatically enroll people in a savings plan, or you can inform people about what other people are doing. And these things are nudges in the sense that they have a steering quality, but they're not shoves, they're not coercive. People can go their own way. So the basic idea is maintain freedom, maintain liberty of choice, but at the same time, give people a little help.
In your introduction, you write that governments can be made better and people's lives easier by getting rid of unnecessary complexity. Why are regulations often so unnecessarily complex?
I think there are a number of reasons. One is that the people who write the rules, they're often specialists. Their job is to write rules. They may know a ton about immigration, for example, and so in working on a rule that involves immigration, they have a stock of knowledge in their heads, which ordinary people who deal with the rules just lack. So I think of regulators sometimes as a little bit like locals in a place that you're visiting where you ask them where's the gas station and they tell you a bunch of stuff that you don't quite get and then they say you can't miss it. And of course, at least I always do miss it after getting that. And regulators, I think, because they have all this information in their minds that people have to deal with the rules lack, they often make things pretty hard to navigate.
So how do we get past that? I know people have come into various administrations and said, I'm going to have everything simplified. And here we are, the same boat we have been in for, I don't know, 100 years or so, maybe more?
We got a better boat now because the last 3 years had some quiet but pretty fabulous and successful efforts at simplification. So President Obama ordered a government-wide look back, it's called, at regulations on the books that have taken away a very large number of rules and actually billions of dollars in compliance costs, billions of dollars in compliance costs. That's been an engine of simplification, the look back. And recently in January it was announced, and this was something I worked on a lot in the administration, that we're eliminating 100 million annual hours in paperwork burdens, 100 million. So the paperwork burdens are getting smaller. Hospitals are being relieved of various burdens under a rule issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. Department of Labor, which isn't maybe famous for eliminating paperwork burdens, had a very important rule to take away 1.6 million annual hours in paperwork and reporting burdens. So there's been a lot happening over the last 3 years to try to simplify the system.
Well, President Obama ran for office promising to improve transparency. Later we'll get back to some of the ways he has let a lot of people down. But right now, let's stick to your argument here. It seems to have two parts. First, that people make systematic errors in judgment. And second, that government can be better if policy is designed to take that into account. Can you give us some examples of the mistakes people make and how government can influence behavior for the better?
Yes. Well, in many domains, people are terrific decision makers, and I don't think we need to belabor that good fact about the human race. But if you're thinking of the long term, sometimes people give it too little weight. So sometimes when people are thinking about, well, smokers may be the most obvious case, the long-term health effects aren't that salient to smokers, certainly when they start out. And sometimes when people are thinking about savings for retirement, they think, well, that's kind of a foreign country. That is 2000 whatever in the 30 years out, 20 years out. So sometimes people procrastinate, and that can cause a lot of trouble. We know also from a lot of data that people are systematically optimistic, about 80% of the population. People believe that they are less likely to fall prey to certain problems than the average person. In fact, the majority of smokers have been found to believe that they are less likely to get lung cancer and heart disease than the average non-smoker.
And so, drivers all believe that they are superior to the other drivers on the road.
Exactly. About 90% of drivers think that they're above average in terms of safety.
Well, how much of our attitude comes out of, in fact, the whole to-do that we had about Maya Bloomberg's number of suggestions he's made have to do with an extension of the ideas of the British philosopher John Stuart Mill?
I think a lot. And Mill is, you know, one of the all-time great philosophers, and his emphasis on freedom of choice is very important, and it's a good foundation, but sometimes you build on foundations.
Well, he suggested that we know what's best for us, but you've already said that we don't always. But do you think this has led to the resistance of of government regulations as a form of paternalism, often also derided as the nanny state?
I do. And I think that we need always to scrutinize rules that second guesses people's own judgments about what's best for them. So the skepticism about the nanny state is a healthy part of our society. But you can't get a prescription medicine just because you want it. And you can't work in a really dangerous workplace, even if you're willing to run the risk. So we do have some rules that are designed to protect people against their own misjudgments.
Was the soda ban a nudge? It didn't actually bar buying lots of soda, just individual huge ones.
It was beyond a nudge. So I haven't investigated the soda ban enough to have formed a view, but I can just say in terms of its own scope, a nudge doesn't impose a cost or a sanction, meaning a penalty, on people who want to go their own way. So automatic enrollment in a savings plan is a nudge. You can just opt out. An educational campaign is a nudge. A grocery store that designs itself so that you see apples before you see the fudge, that's a nudge. The soda ban isn't an aggressive form of paternalism, but it goes beyond a nudge.
Labeling foods for trans fats? And
that's a nudge.
That's just a nudge. What about wearing seatbelts in a car or helmets when they're on a motorcycle?
That's a mandate. So if you have an educational campaign that says it's pretty good to buckle your seatbelts, or if you have a campaign that says protect your kids, they don't want you hurt, or if you have a campaign that says most people are buckling up, you should too, those are all nudges. And I don't mean to say that things that go beyond nudges are typically off limits. The seatbelt mandate seems to be broadly accepted and saving some lives. But what we have with seatbelts and motorcycle helmets, that's beyond a nudge.
So some people object. But then we're often confused about this thing. We don't object when the government bans use of certain drugs.
Yes. Yeah, so I think the way to
even think, though I could decide for myself that it's perfectly fine to use heroin or cocaine, why should the government get involved?
Well, I think the basic framework should be this, that if the government wants to help people when they're making choices that aren't serving their interests, people are running risks that maybe are going to cost them their lives or a limb, the first line of defense should not be a mandate, but should be information, warnings, nudges. There are cases, though, and the seatbelt mandate is an arguable example where you go beyond the nudge, and the reason is that the benefits of the mandate justify the costs. So when I was in the Obama administration, we placed a great emphasis on careful analysis of benefits and costs. And if you have a case where the benefits of a restriction are really, really high, and the costs are pretty low, like you're going to save a lot of lives, and it's not a major intrusion on liberty, then it's at least worth consideration.
Cass R. Sunstein, his latest book, Simpler, The Future of Government. Regulators often seem to be going after the last crime or crisis. Why isn't our regulatory state more proactive? Couldn't more active oversight have prevented the abuses that led to the financial crisis, for example? Well, there were warnings that things were going on.
Yes. I'd say generally that the government, especially under the impetus of the kinds of professionalism that have been emphasized in the last few years, it is being pretty proactive about risks, whether they involve risks in highway, risks in the financial system, which Dodd-Frank is responsive to, whether it involves risks that are associated with health that the Affordable Care Act is responsive to. So I think we do learn, and that there is in many instances, there are safeguards in place that are going to help us in the long term.
But are we looking for the next problem?
I hope not. I hope we're not concentrating, as you said, just on yesterday, and that we are looking at tomorrow. I think to look at the next problem may be a little insufficiently systematic. So what we want to look at is the universe of risks, what's likely to crop up, where people are likely to get hurt, and to be as disciplined as we can about costs and benefits as a way of figuring out what to do.
Well, many people felt that Glass-Steagall did just that, and yet we got rid of it.
Well, the Glass-Steagall provision, there's a lot of controversy. I think the view among the economics profession, and I confess I'm a lawyer, not an economist, but the view is the Glass-Steagall Act is ill-suited to the current situation. That's not a unanimously held view, and that there are other tools which Dodd-Frank deploys to try to reduce the risk of financial meltdown.
You call your approach libertarian paternalism. Can't that be seen as an oxymoron?
Yes, absolutely. And so the first paper Dick Thaler, the economist, and I wrote on this was called Libertarian Paternalism is Not an Oxymoron. And the reason that it's not an oxymoron, if it isn't, is that you can have approaches that have a paternalistic feature in the sense that they're trying to steer people in directions that are good, but that are also libertarian in the sense that they enable people to go their own way. So if you have a plan involving, let's go back to savings, where workers are automatically enrolled in a savings plan, but they can opt out if they want, that is both paternalistic and it is libertarian. If you have a system of health warnings, as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration does, to try to steer people away from certain risks, they can run those risks if they want. They just get the information. And the steering comes with a warning, but it isn't a mandate. So,
go ahead.
What's probably important to see is that libertarians emphasize freedom of choice, and there are many domains in which that emphasis is right. Paternalists emphasize that people might get themselves into big trouble, and there are many areas in which that's also right. And we can kind of meld the libertarian interest in preserving freedom with the paternalistic concern that you also want to give people a little help.
Do you think that one of the things people find objectionable in paternalism is that an elite minority is imposing rules on the majority while granting itself some exemptions?
Well, that would be unfortunate if it happened. So if you had...
Isn't that what Congress does all the time?
Well, if Congress has a self-exemption, that may be a troubling idea.
Well, look at their health program.
And it wouldn't be, I don't think, well, it might be a form of selective paternalism. And there is a old idea in political theory against self-exemption, which is designed to help ensure that the rulers aren't imposing on people some constraints that they wouldn't impose on themselves.
My guest is Cass R. Sunstein, Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, Director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy there. And from 2009 to 2012, he served as the Administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. His latest book, Simpler, with the R kind of crossed out, so I guess you want to say simple and simpler, The Future of Government. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. We are back with Professor Cass R. Sunstein. His latest book, Simpler, The Future of Government, published by Simon & Schuster. Many attempts to influence behavior may seem purely political to some, but for people's good to others. For example, the dispute over same-sex marriage might be an example. How do you distinguish coercion that may be needed from the purely political kind?
I'm not sure what you mean by political. I think in the same-sex marriage debate, the nations in the midst of a philosophical debate, the direction of the movement is clear, and that is in favor of allowing same-sex marriage. And that is political in the sense that there's a political movement for it.
Well, there's also there are also political considerations for people who might resist voting for something like same-sex marriage because they know they're going to be defeated back home.
Yes. So there's a pervasive issue for a politician, which is whether you vote what you think is right or you vote what you think will get you be reelected. And there's a good argument that politicians, certainly on matters of conscience, should do what they think is right.
Not long after Nudge was published, your former colleague at the University of Chicago, Barack Obama, was elected president. Did you know from the start that you would have a role in his administration?
I didn't know, but I admire him so much, and the chance to serve I thought would be a great honor, so I was hopeful.
Did he give you a choice of jobs?
It wasn't like that, really. It was more informal discussions, and I made clear that this would be a job I'd be greatly honored to have. That is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs.
Well, what is its mission or mandate?
It has two missions. One is to oversee the imposition of paperwork burdens on the American people.
When did that start?
In the early 1980s, under Jimmy Carter and quickly picked up by Ronald Reagan. So one idea is that before the government tells you you have to fill out a form, that little office has to say it's okay. And the second and probably the more consequential role is to oversee federal regulation, meaning that if something's coming from the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, it has to get the sign-off of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs.
And when you took over that job, were there policy areas that you already had in mind as needing reform or revision?
I was focused more broadly on the fact that the economy was in a very dangerous situation, and the goal was to ensure that we had smart rules, whether they involved the environment or labor or transportation, that wouldn't compromise the economic recovery. So it was a broad kind of structural concern rather than particular ones.
You described cost-benefit analysis as a nudge on government. What do you mean by that?
You could imagine government officials thinking, you know, what do the interest groups think, or what will get political points, or what are my intuitions, or when has a problem caused harm in the recent past? And my view is those are all inadequate foundations for figuring out what to do about clean air or clean water or safety on the highways. And what you want to do is something like what baseball has actually started to do, which is to be very statistical. So if you have a rule that's going to cost $500 million and the benefits are really small, there's reason to be careful before you proceed. On the other hand, if you have a rule that's going to cost $50 million and it's going to save a ton of lives, that sounds like a bargain.
But that's when the debate begins, when the president proposes doing spending a lot of money to examine the workings of the brain. He says there's a cost benefit from it, and his critics say this is throwing a lot of money at absolutely nothing that's going to be worthwhile.
In the regulatory context, it's usually more tractable. So one thing I found was that a lot of the issues that you might think in the abstract would cause terrible value dilemmas, in practice were much more possible to analyze. So we did in the Obama administration a mercury rule involving air pollution. It's a pretty expensive rule. It's in the billions. But the life savings in terms of the numbers of lives are huge. And on any kind of technical analysis of the benefits and costs, the mercury rule is really worth it. And another rule involving a pretty famous rule, a series actually of rules involving fuel economy for cars, where they're getting more fuel efficient. It was supported, not incidentally, by the automobile industry. And these rules were not cheap either. But the benefits in terms of air pollution benefits, benefits to consumers, benefits in energy security really dwarfed the costs. And so that one was easy, too. There are other rules that you could imagine where you'd be spending, you know, $1 billion or more, and you wouldn't get the kinds of benefits we got from the mercury and fuel economy rules. And
although there was resistance when you imposed those rules as well.
Yes, I think unanimity about an environmental rule would be hard to achieve. But the fuel economy rule for automobiles and for trucks was widely applauded by a wide variety of people. And the mercury rule, while, you know, I mention it because it was one of the more expensive rules, it was not thought by the power industry to be the best thing that ever happened. But it was regarded as a reasonable initiative in the sense that, gosh, the benefits are pretty high and the costs were manageable and the deadlines were also not too stringent.
You're a law professor, but behavioral economics underpins many of your policy proposals. Can you explain how you use behavioral economics and how it altered what economists are doing now?
Yes. So I'll say a little bit about the academic side and then a little bit about the government sides. So economists have treated human beings as rational actors, which in the abstract sounds pretty sensible, but they have a very particular understanding of rationality, which suggests that people always choose the best means to their ends. And at the University of Chicago, as a kind of kid lawyer in the 80s, I was surrounded by these people who are talking about rational choice theory and how people are rational. And some of them also were divorced or struggling in their lives or making bad investments and complaining about them or not getting along with their colleagues and playing tennis in a kind of crazy way with topspin forehands that they were incapable of hitting. And so there was a disjunction between their emphasis on human rationality and their own kind of human fallibility. And what behavioral economists have done is say that those people who, you know, hit the topspin backhands when they're really not capable of and sometimes make bad investment decisions and end up in unpleasant divorces, that's what human beings are like. And so behavioral economics tries to do economics with real rather than made up human beings. And that would have implications for how we think, for example, of a disclosure policy. If you give people 200 pages of complex material and then say, okay, now you understand your mortgage, someone who's rational in a certain economic sense may be able to handle that, but not someone who is human. So what we tried to do in government was trying to make sure that people can understand information disclosure so it actually helps them make informed decisions. That's one example of how behaviorally informed regulation can be a little more useful than regulation that assumes people are like well-functioning computers.
My guest is Cass R. Sunstein. His latest book, Simpler, The Future of Government, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, behavioral economics is still a fairly new field. If there continues to be a wait-and-see attitude on something as important as environmental science, which has been studied for many decades, is there a similar attitude about behavioral economics?
Yes and no. I think no in the sense that we know people care about fairness, not just about money, so that people will often sacrifice some money in order to be fair, and they'll often punish unfairness in order to punish unfairness at their own economic expense. We also know that when people think about probability, I mentioned that a lot of people are optimistic. We also know that people tend not to run the statistics, but to think, can I think of a case where this happened in the recent past? And that fact about human thinking can lead us to be not scared about things that really are threatening because they didn't happen, and scared about things that aren't that threatening just by fluke they happened. And so we do have some sense of what a human behavior and thinking is life in a way is like in a way that is steady. But there's a lot more to learn. So that's the sense in which what you say is exactly right, that the next generation, we're going to know a lot better about human behavior.
We're seeing this play out in the reaction to Hurricane Sandy and how some people are predicting many more Hurricane Sandys. Others saying this was just a fluke. So
yes. Yes. And there's another feature, by the way, of human rationality I think that is super interesting and really important, which is if you present people with balanced information about climate change or the minimum wage or capital punishment or any politically contested issue, present diverse people with this, the people who are very conservative will get more confident and more extreme in their conservatism. And the people who are liberal will get more confident, more extreme in their liberalism. So left-wing and right-wing people tend to divide more sharply after they get balanced presentations. We know that about people. And I think this is informative about the situation we find ourselves in and a kind of warning about how human thinking can increase rather than reduce political polarization.
Has it always been thus, or does it just feel like it's that has gotten exacerbated in recent years?
Well, this phenomenon I'm describing, by which balanced information produces unbalanced views, balanced information can divide people more sharply. We have data going back to the 1970s on it, and we don't have reason, I don't think, to believe it's worse now than it was the 70s or 80s. And it may be built into the human brain, something like this. Maybe we'll know more about that in the next few years. But it's a problem, and one good question is whether there's anything we can do about it.
Is there anything we can do about it?
I think so. I think to know that your own prior convictions might bias your assessment of material is a kind of inoculation. So that's one step. We also know that if people hear some view they don't like or don't want to believe being supported by someone they do like and do believe, then they're more willing to listen. So a surprising validator, that's a kind of ugly term, but it's the best I've got for it, a surprising validator can have credibility and move people both on the left and right sometimes to think a little more in accordance with the facts.
Well, before you were nominated for OIRA, you seemed to get along well with politicians across the political spectrum. You were seen as liberal-leaning but open to regulatory reform. And then Georgia Republican Saxby Chambliss put a block on your nomination.
And he wasn't the only one. Yeah, I had a series of blocks, three of whom I know because they were willing to meet with me. I did find Washington a surprising place in the sense that the willingness to attack anyone because that person was associated with the president was a revelation to me. So I do have many friends on both sides of the aisle and certainly respect Republicans in the Senate and the House. I worked well with them once I got on the job, but it was the confirmation process is it's something.
Getting back to the whole business of nudges, it can seem like health insurance companies want to make going to the doctor more complicated with paperwork, referrals, co-payments, etc. Some people skip going to the doctor just because of all the hurdles. That seems like a counterproductive nudge when it comes to someone's health.
Yes, I do think that
it does reduce the cost for the insurer.
Yes. So the first point I think is if people aren't going to the doctor or are having terrible experiences with the healthcare system because of paperwork burdens and duplication and redundancy and harassment, not of any really horrific sort, but harassment meaning you have to fill out more and more forms, that is a problem. And I think we should all in the private sphere and the public sphere be working hard to simplify life in this very sensitive domain.
So nudges can sometimes work to the benefit of some, but work against others.
No question. So you could imagine someone who's trying to discourage people from engaging in certain commercial activity or from knowing of their rights. And what they do is they fuzz stuff up and they introduce so much complexity. So in the financial area, one risk at least is that some people get in trouble with respect to cell phone plans or credit cards or mortgages because the market sometimes rewards complexity and it's not deception, but it's a little bit of hiding of things. And that the best companies, I think, are increasingly not hiding things and opting for simplicity. And certainly that's one of the missions of the new Consumer Bureau, is to ensure that people know before they owe.
You write about the importance of disclosure as a policy nudge. In fact, that's a perfect example.
Yes. And one thing we did in the Obama administration that I think has general lessons is a lot of people were confronted with something called the food pyramid. It's extremely difficult to figure out what you're supposed to eat. There's some person, male or female, don't know, walking toward the top of a pyramid. All these foods are bunched at the bottom. One of them looks like a shoe. You're supposed to eat a shoe? Probably not. But the food pyramid is it's a good faith effort, but it's baffling. We got rid of that and replaced it with something called the food plate, which is very simple. And I think often if we go plate, not pyramid in life, we'll be doing better.
You do eat a shoe or a hat when you lose a bet, but that's the only time. President Obama ran for office promising to improve transparency, but he's aggressively prosecuted whistleblowers, and he's been criticized for being secretive in other areas, including secrecy about the administration's interpretation of some law. For example, the Justice Department has secret opinions about the Patriot Act, Section 215, which covers access to records under FISA. Do you think that disclosure is needed there?
That's not an area that my portfolio
ventured
into.
But you're a lawyer. You're a law professor.
Well, I think there – so here's a general point. The Obama administration has had extraordinary and really historic transparency initiatives. And if you doubt that, go on to the website data.gov, which has over 300,000 data sets, which are all made public. And these are being released. They're being created as a basis for apps. Some of them involve highway safety. Some of them involve the environment, some of them involve crime. They come from all parts of the government. So in terms of leading the movement toward transparency and increasing disclosure, I think the Obama administration has been amazing, really, and has not gotten the credit that it's due. There's an open government partnership, which is worth a look also, OGP as it's called, which has been led by the United States, which is a worldwide effort to promote transparency. Now, there are a few areas where transparency meets countervailing considerations. One is personal privacy. So while I wasn't involved in the areas you discussed, I was involved in the open government effort more broadly. And we didn't want to have our open government policies be something where people's personal information, you know, personally identifiable information, would be in the public domain if they didn't want it to be. So privacy is a check. There's a balance to be struck. Another is, I think, the area you're describing, which is national security. So I think it's a little too easy, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, to say that everything that bears on national security or everything that, you know, maybe should be scrutinized should be in every word, every term, every hard decision should be disclosed. Some of these things are legitimately kept secret as a way of helping to keep our nation safe.
Well, that debate will continue some other time because we've run out of time. My guest is Cass R. Sunstein, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and Director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy. He served from 2009 to 2012 as the administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. His book, Simpler, The Future of Government, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. A pleasure.